Hello and welcome to Book Talk. This week, Oh Tell Me the Truth About Love. Clive James and Peter Porter with the last of six programs on sex and love in literature and the arts.
Thomas Mann never let go of the idea of the grand passion. Right to the end, he was in love. And it's an example of the desire being there with almost no concrete outlet or expression. And it makes me wonder if maybe the desire is the last thing we'll have. That will be the last little star we see.
The young Sydney poet Clive James arrived in London in the early 60s. His compatriot, the Brisbane poet Peter Porter, had been living there for nearly a decade. With a further 40 years of life and literature behind them, Clive and Peter have been reflecting on sex and love in literature and the arts. This week they consider the role of the arts in teaching us about love and sexuality.
Peter, this is our sixth program, and unfortunately time dictates it has to be the last, and we've barely begun. But one of the themes we started off was sex in the arts as a way to the truth, and this is what still strikes me as the essential achievement of modern times. It's one of the ways we define modern art. I was reading about Toulouse-Lautrec over the weekend, and I never stopped looking at Lautrec. For me, Lautrec is one of the great artistic heroes, and what he found in the dance halls was sexuality and women doing these strange, crazy, sexy dances. And for him, it was the entree into a whole world of realism, which he made poetic and which helped to make modern poetry as I see it and sense it. To me, I think this is still true. But the question is, now that we can say everything, now that nothing is forbidden, is anything exciting?
Well, nothing is forbidden, but there is an artistic decorum at the back of the mind, which I speak for myself especially here, that I know I have a sense. I think on a previous program we did talk about self-censorship, and there are two kinds of self-censorship. One of them, I think, is of the bad kind. You just don't want to say something which is embarrassing, you don't want to say something which will make you look almost like a peeping Tom. And the better kind of self-censorship is your artistic limitations kind of censorship, which simply says, yes, you could put all this material in, but it would be otiose. Don't put it in, you know. Find instead a representative part of it. And therefore, the whole business of truth-telling has to be modified by shapeliness. It has to be modified by the sense to which the satisfaction given to the reader is implied not only by the truthfulness of the statement, but is also implied by the very way in which the statement is made. John Forbes, late John Forbes in Sydney, actually used to have an argument. I think it was with Gig Ryan. He would say, eloquence is the only truth. And Gig would say, oh no, truth is the only eloquence. But the answer is, I would be on Forbes' side. Eloquence is more likely to be true than truth is likely to be eloquent.
It could also be said that what we see as true needs also to be modified by morality. There's a danger of finally having the courage to see something and then believing it to be eternally true just because you've had the courage to see it. Like, it is a truth, for example, that throughout history, one of the rewards for being an older and successful and rich man is to pick younger and younger wives and mistresses. Mm-hmm. But is this a law? Or is it merely a description of what has happened in conditions of absolute power? And should it be modified? I was stunned all over again on the weekend. I was reading my old admiration, E.E. Cummings, and just reading on the fringes of him, and it reminded me of a poem of his I knew by heart. It was one of the first poems of Cummings that I ever learned, and I've still got it in my mind. I'm going to try now. And as it flares past us, and it's a brilliantly rhythmic achievement, just examine some of the assumptions in it. He's talking to a girl. You shall, above all things, be both glad and young. For if you are young, whatever life you wear, it will become you. And if you are glad, whatever's living will yourself become. Boy-girls may nothing more than girl-boys need. I can entirely her only love, whose any mystery makes man's flesh put space on, and his mind take off time. That you should ever think, may God forbid, and in his mercy your true lover spare, for that way knowledge lies, the fetal grave called progress, and negation's dead undoom. I'd rather learn from one bird how to sing than teach 10,000 stars how not to dance. Now, in 1958, I was terribly impressed by that last couplet, and terribly impressed by the whole poem, but even then there was an inkling, niggling little doubt. What's all this about not thinking? And why is he instructing the woman to keep her brains empty?
Well, I think Shakespeare shows us very readily that the better a woman can think, the more attractive she's likely to be. In fact, I find myself totally opposed to the coming view of that.
I was opposed at the time, but the music still got me.
And the music's there. Yeah. To set against that a completely unmusical passage, which I remember, which always impressed me quite the opposite direction. It occurs in that very early, perhaps the first novel of Iris Murdoch, which was called Under the Net, in which the hero is lamenting the fact that he's not going to see this woman probably for a long time, just towards the end of the book. And he says, it doesn't matter, he said. There's nothing, she's a very intelligent woman, and there's nothing like brains to make someone keep, using a refrigeration metaphor. And I think that that is the truth as well. Shakespeare's Rosalind and Shakespeare's various kinds of clever girls, Helena in All's Well That Ends Well, it is true that they're rather stupid blokes, tend to think they'd be put off. You know, men are supposed to be put off by brainy girls. But in fact, the men finally come around to the fact that the brainy girls are not only brainy, they're very attractive and they know exactly how to govern the kind of fatuous uselessness of so much masculine adoration in it.
Nevertheless, it is a strain among male artists, especially the more troubled ones, to think that there might be some sort of refuge in the arms of a clueless woman. Hazlitt, for example, Hazlitt was an extremely complicated man, but he did have that dream, and it led to a disaster, of course, because the clueless woman who will nevertheless understand us and look after us doesn't exist. If she's going to understand us, then she's got to be a lot more than clueless.
That's perfectly true. I think you can escape sex. I think all of us are so wound up in our own sexuality that we think it is, after all, it has been called the ever-interesting topic, etc. But there are a few people around who, we have examples of them in literature, who manage to escape from sexual desire by appearing to actually follow it, but not doing so. I'm particularly interested in Falstaff in this respect. I think it was Auden pointed out about Falstaff that he, almost all of his conduct is designed to prevent him having to compete sexually. He gets fat because fat people are not usually so attractive. Everything he does is to keep out of the sexual drag. And therefore, when the Queen told Shakespeare that she was to show him in love, Shakespeare could only write a rather bad play because there was no way in which love really centred in Falstaff's personality. I mean, he had lots of women around him, but there was no sense of romantic love in Falstaff anywhere. There was a lot of romantic daring and doing, and which of course turned out to be completely false, as in the field of the Battle of Shrewsbury and that sort of thing. But the point is, I think that it is sometimes a very good thing to reflect that you might wake up one morning and no longer have any sexual feelings at all. And you might feel a deliberation, you might feel a terrible disqualification, but it's something that has to be considered. It's said, isn't it, that at the end of his life, somebody asked Sophocles what it felt like to be 90. He said, mercifully free from sexual desire.
I think it's quite probable that Shaw never had any sexual feelings. It's the only way I can explain the serenity and his universal flirtation with women of every age and caste, is that it really didn't impinge on that. He didn't really care, and that gave him his marvellous lightness of heart. But there is the question of an artist like, say, Thomas Mann. I continually come back to Thomas Mann and sexuality because he's an extreme case. It's quite likely that after he generated his children, that was the end of his heterosexual life. It's almost certain that his homosexual life amounted to almost nothing except an occasional glance exchange with a waiter that way inclined, or often not that way inclined. And yet out of these tiny hints, these tiny moments, Thomas Mann never let go of the idea of the grand passion. Right to the end, he was in love. And it's an example of the desire being there with almost no concrete outlet or expression. And it makes me wonder if maybe the desire is the last thing we'll have. That will be the last little star we see.
I'm fairly sure that's the case. If you can actually fall out of love completely, that might be a very good thing. But if you can't fall out of love, you can go on loving without necessarily having to worry too much about the sexual performance, actually.
What about the artist who turns against sexuality when he himself is no longer capable of it? I think particularly of Tolstoy. It's the unmistakable message of some of Tolstoy's later and shorter works that he actually disapproves of the early Tolstoy, the one who was diving around with the chambermaids.
But this can be done as humorous, as Rochester does in a poem called The Maimed Debauchee, which is quite funny. But no, Tolstoy wasn't funny about it at all. He took it desperately seriously. But the reformed rake, of course, is a well-known figure in this direction. There are two ways of being reformed. There's a Tolstoyan way, which is really to have a considerable distaste for what you did before. There is the Rochesterian way, before he got completely clapped out at the end, which is to just simply lament you can no longer do it, which is a quite different form of reformation.
Which we used to, in my part of Australia, namely 6 Margaret Street, Cogra, we used to call being philosophical. That's what being philosophical meant.
I think it is, yes.
Drawing a measure, making an account book of life and reaching the correct measure, the correct estimate.
But the doing without sex and the doing without love are not quite the same thing, are they? I think that, well, you mentioned earlier too, Goethe was always in love. And I think that falling in love is something which can go on forever and ever.
It did in his case.
It did.
I actually got his age wrong when we were talking about the Marianne Bad elegy. Mm. And I've looked up the details, and he was actually, he wasn't in his 80s, he was in his 70s, mid-70s. But I was wrong about the girl, too. She wasn't in her 20s, she was 19. Yeah. And he offered marriage to her, and his go-between was one of the crown princes. Mm. It was a very, very serious business, and the family thought about it before they turned him down. And Goethe undoubtedly made a fool of himself. But he knew he'd made a fool of himself. And to him it was worth it. First of all, he wrote the Marianne Bad elegy, and he always meant it when he said, if I'm not in love or someone is not loving me, I'm not alive. Mm-hmm. And that's the way he felt, and look what it produced. Mm-hmm. And it takes a very brave man to say that, well, Goethe was a fool and would have been a better poet if he hadn't behaved that way or thought that way.
I've always thought that in the end, on your deathbed, what you'd want to have a vision of is not quite what Dante had of Beatrice, because he didn't really know awfully much about Beatrice. But what you could have is the kind of eidolon or eidolon of Beatrice. This is an extension of the kind of dissatisfaction which one has, at least I have, of my early life. There was so much I didn't do when I was young, so much I was too frightened to do. I would like a vision, a beneficent vision on my deathbed, that it would have been worthwhile to do it when it was possible to do it.
This was one of Larkin's themes, wasn't it, also? Yeah. Is that sex was something that you were deprived of because it happened to a later generation, the Beatles generation.
Mm. One of the reasons, I think, for having this kind of vision is that literature has shown you something which is very liberating, really, all forms of literature. I was just thinking the other day about Mozart's Marriage of Figaro, or for that matter, Beaumarchais' Marriage of Figaro, of course, which is that the sexual drive actually breaks down class barriers. Now, of course, the way in which the class barriers operate means that it doesn't actually break them down. But in a work of art, the humblest servant and the greatest master is equally eloquent. Art gives eloquence to all particular states. And the power of sexuality, for instance, in a servant, even if it's expressed comically, like Sancho Panza, is as important and as felt as the power of sexuality in the great master or the sort of figure who is the main person. So I think that Don Giovanni is no more sexual than Leporello. Leporello, however, is comically sexual, enviously sexual, and always looking for a little bit of bread from the master's table. The master has a superfluity and is much more, in a way, disturbed by it than the servant. I never worry, as many people do, that great works of art appear to represent a society deeply divided into class and position, because once they are rendered into art, a new kind of democracy takes over, the democracy of the power of expression.
And in that sense, Figaro is an even more subversive work than Giovanni, isn't it?
Yes, much more.
Susanna is the Count's moral superior, and that's that.
Precisely. It's the duty of the artist, however, to give everybody a fair crack of the whip. And so why it's attractive to be a writer, it rather more attractive, really, to be a writer than to be a prime minister, is that you have no power as a writer, except that you've got absolute power, because you've got the absolute power that these characters are in your mind, whereas the Prime Minister, you know, can bomb Baghdad, but he can't really make people think as he wants to.
No, the writer has more power, and I think the painter has more power than the writer. If I come back again to Earth, I'll be a painter, there's no question, because it's the best way of caring just the right amount about sex. I was once taught by a great man who, alas, is no longer with us, the photographer Terence Donovan.
Mm-hmm.
I was telling him about what the vision of beauty had done for me all my life, and he said, yeah, you're overdoing this, you've got a bad case of it. What you want to do is come with me to Paris, to the Paris Collections, and in 2 weeks you'll see more beautiful women than you ever imagined existed, and you'll be cured. And you know, it worked. I made a movie with him, and I was surrounded by the kind of face and figure that had been disturbing me all my life.
Mm-hmm.
And realizing that there were thousands of them helped me to get things in perspective. It didn't make it meaningless, but it did concentrate my mind at last on individuality and cured me of a very bad habit of what's the word for it, idealization, of seeing something beautiful and imagine that it had all the moral and mental qualities, and sometimes it hadn't, and that's your salvation.
Yeah, I think that my problem would be the same as that, except that my form of idealization would always be accompanied by an element of obsession, that somehow that one would be looking for a particular one. You sometimes say to yourself that even the most slight acquaintance with the person who is the idée fixe is more important than a whole panorama of beautiful people, but who are just in some way not part of you. I mean, and between those two visions, I think, is most of human life is lived. But it's a real form of cowardice, actually. You escape from the real problems of life back into books and back into paintings and back into music, because there, it's not a question that they're ideals, but there they don't harm you. It's like what Caliban said to, you know, this music. It says, it gives delight and hurts not.
I'm interested in the producers of art in the sense that I want to know how they behave under extreme provocation, because if I know that, maybe I can make my own life better. And the reason I bring up the painters is that they live under extreme provocation. When you think of what happened to Renoir, Renoir's models were all the girls of Montmartre who washed clothes. They worked in laundries and so on. And they were glad to model for him and extremely glad to go to bed with him for a tiny extra fee. Mm. And then their mothers would show up and try and persuade Renoir to marry the girl, because that was the girl's best chance of a decent life and so on. And he was living in what can only be described as heaven. He behaved very well because he was a very, very sensible man. Whereas we would think that the Rodin, who had all the same opportunities, didn't really behave all that well. Rodin could have treated Gwen John much better. He could have treated Camille Claudel much better. Though I think the reason for being interested in artists' biographies at all is to see what they did, how they comported themselves in these extreme conditions. And I find it very, very instructive. Sanity is a worthwhile aim and can be attained, but it's best attained through satisfaction rather than through frustration. Frustration is very bad for you, in my view.
I think it is indeed. But there's a kind of possible satisfaction which is offered you which you don't want, and that can be awful. I mean, Auden put it nicely in one of his little couplets where he said, if equal affection cannot be, let the more loving one be me.
Yes.
I mean, most of us are probably not beautiful or successful or happy enough to have people round our necks. But if it has ever happened to you at all, it makes you terribly appreciative that you shouldn't do it to others. I mean,
yes.
You sit at home and writing your fierce love poem about this person who's rejected you, but then you suddenly get a remembrance of what it was like to be someone whom somebody else was doing this to you, and it fills you with revulsion, and it gives you the perfect opportunity to understand, I mean, unless you're uglier than sin, I suppose, it gives you the perfect opportunity to understand what a burden somebody else's affection can be.
Yes.
and how deeply it can be wounding to the person who feels it.
I think without the arts, and the arts themselves, and learning about the people who made them, I would scarcely have progressed past the age of 16 in my emotional life. So I'm very glad of it. And it's also been a good time to be alive, because I think it's beyond doubt true that feminism has improved the world. Australia in my time, which is really your time, wasn't really a great place for a man to receive a sexual education. And feminism has made things better in that it's made us think, made us realize that women are alive too, for example. A point that I had a great deal of trouble grasping when I was young. And I'm grateful. I don't want to sound too craven, because I think there's such a thing as innate decency, and I'd like to think I had some of it. But there's no doubt that the arts can educate you, and I think in our case they probably did.
And they didn't actually make you envious either. It's another interesting thing. Real life made you terribly envious. The artistic works did not do so. And I that's very important. I grew up in a more severely Puritan Australia than you did. One of my party pieces was to say to people, thinking I was being very swanky, that I thought the entire Australian population had been engendered by parthenogenesis. I didn't think there'd been anybody ever going to bed with anybody. That simply seemed to be the state of Brisbane when I was growing up. But in fact it wasn't. It was the state of me, not the state of Brisbane, because it was like Philip Larkin said about, is it the place's fault?
Yeah.
Well, no, it's not the place's fault. It's your own fault, usually.
Yeah. It's been a good time to be alive in that sense. The 20th century was a terrifying century when you look at the wars and the totalitarian states and so on. But artistically, it was unlike any previous time, even the 19th century, in being so concerned with equity in behavior, with the sexes and the classes and so on. And I think in many ways the social revolution was accomplished, and much more painlessly than it need have happened. For example, one of the accomplices in the social revolution, in making it permissible to think subversive thoughts about equality and justice and sexual rights, was in fact the entrenched middle class, the high bourgeoisie and the aristocracy. They didn't fight a rearguard action at all, because it was more important to them to register as being cultivated and sensitive than just to defend their fortresses.
I think that's probably generally true, but it wasn't very true of my family, and it wasn't very true of my aunts and uncles, who were specifically businessmen and very good at avoiding what they didn't want to see. But every time I begin to think, oh, well, really, I had a very parched desert sort of life when I first started off, I then think to myself, well, I'm very glad I wasn't actually living in Bratislava or somewhere else. There was, you're quite right, Bhante, there is a sense of equity in the kind of Australia I grew up in and you grew up in, and also I think in most of the English-speaking countries, which is sometimes seems to be not very prominent for the making of art. It seems to be an obstacle to the making of art, but it is not so, actually, because you appreciate finally that all the best in art has to come out of all that's best in society. And so it's better to grow up in a society, whatever its frustrations, that has a knowledge of equity than one that doesn't.
Yeah. Peter, we're both close enough to the last gasp to ask ourselves how we're going to behave. I don't think a man who is what my friend Bruce Burris would call in the departure lounge is necessarily to be condemned because he gets interested or wants the nurse to be pretty. I've got a feeling there are primal instincts that can be civilized and modified, but finally not denied. If men had made men, in other words, if human beings had designed human beings, there would be much more justice. There would not be these absurdities. But it's not true. We were made as biological mechanisms. And although enlightened feminism has done its best to argue otherwise, there does come a point where you say, well, no, wait a second, finally men are that way, and the best we can hope to do is do something about it. But to deny it is just crazy.
Well, I think we have to think out, odd enough, at the end, not so much about our lovers, but about our mothers, because the mothers were the models for the lovers, and I lost my mother early, of course, and I don't have a very clear picture of her. I think of her very much. But nevertheless, I am sure, rather more than my father, who lived on to be an advanced age, I'm sure that somewhere at the back of my mind, this is the template, this is the archetype, this is something which, at death, I might be able to begin to fit into.
Tragic circumstances deprived my own mother and father of the long life together they should have had, but when I look back at it, I'm glad that they had this much, that they were part of an enlightened generation. It was the beginning of enlightenment, and Australia can be proud of it, I think. And when I look at the future of my own children, it'll be more enlightened still, and I suppose my own generation is going to have to look at all its faults and all its mistakes and yet be grateful that at least they knew what they were, that the subject wasn't under the carpet. And one of the great things the arts have done for us, not just in recent times but from the beginning, is that they bring instincts out into the light. And one of the great instincts is love, and it begins with Homer, at the very least, is that we see its power, we see its devastating consequences, but we see people dealing with it, being as intelligent as they can about it. There's no bigger story, and I just hope, and I'm sure you hope, that the schools go on teaching it.
Clive James, ending that discussion with Peter Porter, and their series of six programs about sex and love in literature and the arts. Peter's latest collection of poems is Max Is Missing. Picador is the publisher. And Picador has just published all three volumes of Clive's autobiography in one volume under the title Always Unreliable.